Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Nibbānaṃ paramaṃ sukhaṃ te. Today is the day we enter the rains retreat. This is the 2538th Vasa since the Parinibbana of the Lord Buddha. However, that my diary suggests that today is actually the full moon day, the true full moon day, and as I came in here you saw the full moon just rise in the sky. And the full moon day of July is called Asauha Puja, and it commemorates the day when the Buddha gave his first sermon, the first teaching of the Dhamma. And that first teaching of the Dhamma, many of you will know, is called the Dhammacakka, Pavattana Sutta, and it remains not just the first sutta, the first teaching of the Buddha in chronology, but it also is one of the first teachings in its content, one of the most powerful and deep explanations and expressions of the thing we call the Dhamma. It was only a couple of months since the Buddha's own enlightenment. The experience still very much fresh in his mind, and that first teaching would have had the full power, the full strength of the enlightenment experience. And so it is a sutta, even though it is short in its length, is a sutta, a teaching which has very deep and profound significance. And I cannot resist this evening taking the opportunity to base this talk on the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, and to bring out some points which may be obscure. Again, the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta was so profound and so powerful that it created the second Arya in the world, Anya Kondanya, the Buddha's first disciple, who, having heard this teaching, gained the fruits of the first stage of enlightenment. He became a Sotapanna, one who had seen the Dhamma, one who had understood the nature of the Buddha's enlightenment experience, and one who was on the path to eventually perfect that experience for himself. And so the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta was an extremely powerful teaching. According to the sutta, at the end of the exposition, the many world systems shook. People with maybe just a rudimentary understanding about Buddhism might take that as a myth. But if one can understand the power of these teachings which were first presented to the world in this sutta, if one really truly experienced and appreciated their meaning, it will become quite obvious that the world systems actually did shake. This was powerful stuff. And as we all know, the Buddha began the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta, the sutta, the teachings, which began the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma, this metaphor of a wheel once turned, which kept rolling on through generation after generation, kept rolling by the arahats. That this teaching began by expressing the middle path. I'm going to bring out another meaning of the middle path today. The middle path was somewhere between two extremes, and the first extreme, which the Buddha mentioned, was the extreme of indulgence, the Kama Sukhalikana Yoga, the indulgence in the realm of karma, which, as I pointed out here many times, is indulgence in the realm of the five senses. Karma being that which finds sensory delight in the world of the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and the physical body, the sense of touch, that is. And we're saying that indulgence in this realm, in the realm of the five senses, is, first of all, he called it hina, low, vulgar, gammo, of the village, of like ordinary, of the worldly people who live in a village, potu janiko, of like the person who hasn't even seen the Dhamma yet, not of the Aryas, not of those who have seen the Dhamma, and not connected with the goal. I can't resist pointing out that the first word he used for a person who indulges in these pleasures of the five senses, this is called hina, the adjective. And the hina Dhamma throughout the Tripitaka was always associated with the world in the village, the world of a man and wife having family, having sex, having the pleasures of the five senses. And any monk or nun who disrobed would always be talked of as returning to the hina Dhamma. And so the way the Buddha used the word hina was that which was concerned with the lay life, that which was concerned with enjoying the realm of the five sense pleasures. And if there is a thing called hina yana, it's exactly the same word. It is that group of people who practice the five sense pleasures. That's how the Buddha meant the term. However, it got a different meaning later on, which was not very accurate. Hina, gammo, of the village, potu janiko, anaryo. This is not concerned with the path towards enlightenment. And that was one extreme, indulging in pleasures. The other extreme is sometimes called self-mortification, but I want to stop using that term this evening. But whatever it is, this is dukkha. It produces pain. And it's also anaryo and atasanyato. It's not of the Aryas, not of the enlightened ones, and it doesn't lead to the goal. And someone pointed out that the words gammo and hino, that the low end of the village is missed out here, because you don't find people in the village, people in the lay life, practicing this sort of path of not indulging the pleasures of the senses, saying no to them again and again and again. And I want to bring to your attention this evening, the Buddha said that this was not the way to achieve Nibbana. Sometimes that people have the idea that one can overcome the kilesas just by saying no to them again and again and again and again and again. Because that particular path will lead to the denying of all the desires which are based on the search for pleasure in the five senses. And it's not just pleasure of the eye and the ear, the nose and the tongue, but also the pleasure of the touch, which we call physical comfort. When one says no to the desire for physical comfort, then one goes to the extreme of denying comfort altogether. And one thinks that if one says no, no, no to these desires which spring up from the body and from the other four external senses, this is not the way which will achieve liberation. This is a very profound point. Renunciation has its place, but this is a gradual path which is more refined and more subtle. Sometimes that we may think that if we don't eat the food we like, if we give up sleeping if too much, and if we live in cold huts, if we wear rough clothes, if we deny comfort of the body, then we'll somehow get somewhere. You do not overcome the defilements of sensory greed and its twin, ill will, hatred, by this method. One overcomes these things, first of all, through understanding. And what does one understand in order to overcome these things? One understands the Four Noble Truths. Very often, some monks get into a problem because they deny, and are very ascetic and very strict, which can be a help, but by itself it's not sufficient to gain these paths and fruits, these stages of enlightenment. It is through wisdom and understanding. And when one gains wisdom and understanding, as I hope we'll have time to illustrate in this talk this evening, the kilesas, the defilements, end by themselves. They end as a result of a causal sequence of one thing leading to another thing. They end, if you like, whether one likes it or not, outside one's choice. Oh, may they end. Oh, may they not end. One needs to gain the first stage of enlightenment before one can truly work on cutting the kilesas, cutting the sensory desire and ill will. However, even though this is an important point, it does help to renounce. It does help to say no to the coarser and grosser forms of sensory delight. That's why there is this middle path. And that middle path is more subtle than you may imagine. This whole teaching of Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta is very profound. Very often, when we take a teaching for granted, and we think we know it, that's where we miss its great impact. If you truly understood the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, you'd be like Venerable Kondanya. You'd be Sotapanna, and you'd be able to declare Yankinchi Samudaya Dhamma, Sabbantang Nirodha Dhammanti. All that is of a nature to arise is of a nature to cease. And know the profundity of even what that means. So having taught these two extremes of trying to solve the problem through indulging the senses and negating them, the Buddha taught the path of understanding. That understanding was the Four Noble Truths. And it's no chance that the Buddha started with the Noble Truth of Dukkha. It's this one which needs to be understood before you can even have a hope of understanding the other three. To know what dukkha is, what its true meaning is, what its depth is so important. I'm mentioning here the importance of the chronological order of the teachings of the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. What comes first is nearly always more important. What comes first is necessary to understand what comes second. So it started with the Noble Truth of Dukkha. And what was the first thing he said about dukkha? Jatipi dukkha. Birth is dukkha. And again, that's one of the most powerful statements which the Buddha could have made. And it's a statement which is sometimes taken for granted, as if, you know, the experience of birth coming out of the womb is somehow dukkha. The Buddha wasn't talking about small things here. This was a profound sutta. I remember years ago, one monk explaining this. Well, when a baby comes out the womb, it cries. It doesn't cry. It gets spanked, and therefore it starts crying. Therefore, that's the meaning of Jatipi Dukkha, that birth is suffering. And I think even at the time that I had an intuition that something so mundane certainly was far from the mind of the Buddha when he was giving his first sermon. Surely there was something much deeper in this very first expression of dukkha. And as many of you will know, that jātipi dukkha, birth is dukkha, can be explained and is rightly explained as saying that birth leads into the dukkha, the existential dukkha of being. In the same way that the most important link in the dependent origination of paṭicca-samuppāda is the first one which the Buddha discovered. What is the origin of dukkha? Jati. Birth. Jati pachaya. Soka parideva dukkha dhammana supaya sāpi. The whole mass of suffering. And with old age and death there as well. And it was that understanding of the profundity of that link, independent origination, which started the whole avalanche of causality, which brought forth the Buddha's understanding of the roots of this cycle of existence we call samsara. But it was the first link which I maintain is the most important of all the links of dependent origination. The first explanation of what dukkha is, that birth is dukkha. What that means is once you are born is dukkha. Dukkha until you die, no matter what you do in between. This is the existential dukkha. I'll mention this a bit later on, because when we go to the last expression of dukkha, when the Buddha brings it all together into an expression of the depth of dukkha. And I'll go back to the meaning of jati, dukkha. I also mention that old age is dukkha, and that death is dukkha. Old age and death, that which lies in store of all beings, for all beings. The old age and death, the passing away. This is, by its very nature, suffering. It didn't say that it's only suffering for the putu-channa, for the one who hasn't seen the Dhamma yet. He didn't say it's suffering for those who still have attachment. He just made this straightforward statement. Old age and death is dukkha for all beings, even the Buddha. When he was sick, he experienced suffering, physical suffering, suffering of the body. Death is suffering. The very nature of it is suffering, is dukkha. Maybe I shouldn't call it suffering, because sometimes people misunderstand that term. Let's call it dukkha. Something which has a much deeper meaning than this physical or this experiential affectation which we call suffering. It's something which by its very nature is unpleasant, something which one would rather do without. So it's jati, jara and marana. Birth, old age and death, a suffering, a dukkha. Apiyehi sampayogo dukkho, piyehi vipayogo dukkho. That which isn't pleasing, which comes to you, is dukkha. That which is pleasing, which you're separated from, is dukkha. That those things which are pleasing are independent of whether one attaches to them or not. There are certain things in life which are pleasing to all beings, whether they're arahats or not. And there are some things which are not pleasing. I was always struck by that sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, where the monks went to a forest and said how pleasing it was. Even arahats enjoyed beautiful forests on the moonlit night. And having known a few arahats in my time, you see that some of them just delight in the beauty of nature. That's nothing to do with the craving or the defilements which lead to the problem. No matter how much wisdom one has, how much release one has, there are certain experiences in the world which are pleasing and some which are unpleasant. Once when the Buddha was meditating, a demon called Suchiloma came to sit next to the Buddha, and this demon was like a punk yakka with spiky hair sticking out all over him. And when he leaned against the Buddha leaned away. And the yakka said, "What's wrong? Have you got preferences that you don't like being touched by the spiky hair?" And the Buddha said, "Of course." And he taught something which was much deeper than a person's ordinary understanding of what an arahat, what an enlightened being should do. There are some things which are pleasant and some things which are unpleasant even for the arahat. And being associated with the unpleasant is dukkha. Being separated from the pleasant is dukkha. This is something which applies to all beings, no matter what state they're in. Throughout the whole cosmos where a being can take birth. Yampi chang navapati dukkha, that which you wish for, which you don't get, is dukkha. And that which one wishes for is in the realm, in my opinion, of those beings who still have desires. Unless one can count the arahats as even wishing some things, such as even arahats wish for the happiness of all sentient beings. They wish for people to become enlightened. And the not getting what one wishes, there will be dukkha. And the last of these explanations of the meaning of dukkha, which the Buddha gave in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, was again just emphasizing the very first. He said, in summary, to bring it all together, that the five grasping groups are suffering. And for those of you who've read Bhikkhu Bodhi's excellent paper on the meaning of the five grasping groups, which is very hard, if not impossible, to deny its validity. But the five grasping groups of dukkha, where he was mentioning that even the arahat has five grasping groups. Five grasping groups being just the five khandhas, the body, feeling, perception, mental formations and consciousness. These five khandhas, the Buddha was saying, are in their essence dukkha, are suffering. That's why the jati, birth, is suffering. Because birth is the first acquisition of these five khandhas. In the Satipatthana Sutta, that birth is specifically defined as the physical birth into the various classes of beings. And this is the explanation of the Four Noble Truths in the Mahasatipatthana Sutta. Having given the First Noble Truth, then the Buddha asks, and what do we mean by birth? What do we mean by old age? What do we mean by suffering? And so forth. So the Buddha defined what he meant. And the Buddha defined that birth, not to mean some metaphorical birth, specifically defined it to mean the birth into this and that class of beings. That which we normally, usually, understand by birth. This is dukkha. This is when we first acquire, in this life, the five khandhas. That's why it's dukkha. The five khandhas are conditioned things. They are, in themselves, sankharas. This word sankhara means that which is conditioned, that which comes into being. Then one of the most powerful statements of the Buddha, in brief, was sabbe sankhara dukkha. All sankharas are dukkha. The sabbe being the most interesting term when he was talking about sabbe sankhara dukkha, all sankharas. This includes five khandhas, that which is conditioned. Or, as the Buddha often said in another way, he asked the monks, Rupa, the body, is body permanent or impermanent, monks? The monks replied, it's impermanent, venerable sir. And then the Buddha carried on, well, what is impermanent? Is that sukha or dukkha? The monks replied, dukkha. Feeling, vedana, is that permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, venerable sir. That which is impermanent, is that sukha or dukkha? Dukkha, venerable sir. Perception, sanya, is that permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, venerable sir. What is impermanent? Is that sukha or dukkha? It is dukkha, suffering. Sankhara, the mental formations, is that permanent or impermanent? It's impermanent, venerable sir. What is impermanent? Is that sukha or dukkha? It is dukkha, venerable sir. And consciousness, vijnana, is that impermanent? Impermanent or permanent? It is impermanent, venerable sir. What is impermanent? Is that sukha or dukkha? It is dukkha, venerable sir. Because each of the five khandhas, the five groups, was impermanent, it meant it was dukkha. These are the five khandhas. They are dukkha because they are impermanent. Even for the arahat, the khandhas are impermanent. Therefore they are dukkha. And the other quote which shows this was where the Buddha said, all that is felt is dukkha. All that is experienced is dukkha. The experience of the arahat, if it's experience, it's dukkha. This is the existential dukkha which the Buddha was talking about, was pointing to in this First Noble Truth. He wasn't just pointing to the suffering which we usually notice when we don't get what we want, when we experience physical pain, when we get frustrated, when we experience anger or whatever. He was talking in a much deeper level, the sankhara dukkha, the dukkha of existence itself, of that which is conditioned. Everything outside the unconditioned element, the deathless element, which is equated to nibbana, all outside of that is dukkha. Once one understands this, one has got an indication of the depth of this thing which we call dukkha. There's one other place where one can understand the meaning of dukkha in the context of the First Noble Truth, is that's when one, through the practice of meditation, starts to let go of the different levels of dukkha. And one starts to let go of the different levels of dukkha by letting go of the three types of formations, the three types of sankhara. The Buddha said that the three types of sankhara in this context are vachi sankhara, kaya sankhara, and chitta sankhara. The sankhara of speech, the sankhara of body, the sankhara of mind. And each one of these is let go of when one is practicing meditation, one is practicing samatha. First of all, you will know that one lets go of the vachi sankhara, the inner speech, and then one lets go of the kaya sankhara at the fourth jhana. And then one lets go of the last sankhara, the mind sankhara, where one enters nirodha. This is the ending of the sankhara dukkha, temporarily. Sariputta mentioned that when he said Nibbana Paramang Sukhang, what was that meaning when in Nibbana there is nothing felt or experienced? This is one of the suttas I was talking about a few weeks ago. And he was saying that the reason why that the experience of Nibbana, when nothing is felt and when nothing is experienced, is neither perception nor feeling nor mental formations nor consciousness. The reason why it's termed the highest happiness is because the most dukkha is eradicated, is abolished. First of all, one abolishes the dukkha, the irritation, the affliction, Sai Buddha said, of the world of the five senses, the external world, concerned with comfort of the body, taste, touch, so taste, smell, sights and sounds. When that's been abandoned, there's a great release of a heavy burden. That which is an affliction is called dukkha, Sai Buddha said to Udayan, who asked the question. That's why the first jhana is considered to be happiness, the first of the Nekama Sukhas, or the Pariveka Sukhas, the Sukhas based on renunciation or seclusion, Sukha being happiness. And the second jhana is even happier than the first jhana, because one has let go of an affliction. And the third, happier than the second. The fourth, happier than the third, because one has let go of two great afflictions when one enters the fourth jhana. Those two afflictions one has let go of is Vachi Sankhara and Kaya Sankhara, the body and speech one has let go of. And when one enters these states, one experiences the bliss. One asks afterwards, when one emerged, why was this blissful? What was the nature and the cause of this happiness? And happiness is the duality in this sense. Happiness is the release from suffering. So you ask, so what was the suffering which I was released from that caused this happiness to be experienced? That which you were released from in fourth jhana is the Kayi Sankhara Dukkata and the Vachi Sankhara Dukkha. The dukkha of the speech formations and the dukkha of the body. Once you know these things, you understand just this inner speech, this thought, this movement of the mind is just such an affliction, such a pain, such a suffering. You understand when you get into fourth jhana that the body is just a pain, just a suffering, just such a heavy burden to carry around. And if one can enter Nirodha and let go of the third of the sankharas, the citta, the mind itself, then one understands that even mind is an affliction, is a burden. Even perception is dukkha. Even vedana is dukkha. Even sankhara is dukkha. Even consciousness itself is dukkha. That's why Nirodha Samapatti, the experience of Nibbana here and now, is called the experience of the highest happiness, Nibbana. You come out of Nirodha Samapatti, you come back to dukkha. Dukkha in the sense that this is not the highest happiness. This is still the existential dukkha of having khandhas, having five groups, having sensory experience, having things which are impermanent, and things which are impermanent by their very nature are suffering. This is such an important point which Venerable Kondanya actually saw. He realized that there's nothing in this world, the physical world or the mental world, worth attaching to. Not only nothing worth attaching to, but because it is suffering, because it is dukkha, it arose, it aroused, raised, is the word I'm looking for, raised in Kondanya, revulsion to this world of body and mind, the nibbida, that negative force which propels a person away from the world of the body and mind. It's something which is very hard for people to understand who haven't experienced a cessation of some type of dukkha, especially in jhanas. Because coming back to this coarse world, when you know something much more refined, you will always look upon that coarse world with a sense of revulsion. Why do you have to come back to this when there's that over there? And the Buddha said this is a natural outcome, nothing to be feel that this is a wrong attitude, this is not unwholesome, but this is actually a wholesome state of mind, this nibbida, this revulsion. There's this reading in Bhikkhu Bodhi's beautiful discourse on the five khandhas and the five grasping groups, just mentioning sort of in there that I'll come back to that point in a moment when I get my thread back again. That the five groups of grasping are essentially dukkha, and that by overcoming the different levels of dukkha, one experiences greater degrees of happiness. And understanding this, it gives rise to this nibbida, this revulsion towards the world. And the point I was coming back to was a quote in that paper by Bhikkhu Bodhi, where he said that even the arahat, this is a Buddha saying, even the arahat should always regard the five khandhas as a boil, as a dart, as, you know, things unpleasant. But why should the arahat have to keep reflecting on these things? The Buddha said, even though he's got nothing left to do, even for the arahat, he should carry on reflecting that these five khandhas are worthy of revulsion, are to be looked upon in ways which cause this revulsion. Because he was saying this gives rise to a sense of happiness here and now. Why is this? Because once the arahat develops the mindfulness, the memory and the experience that the five khandhas are worthy of revulsion, turning away from, the result of revulsion is not a negative state of mind. The result of revulsion is turning away from them. It's viraga, it's dispassion, it's letting go of them, it's going somewhere else. If you develop revulsion against the sore on your body, according to the similes of the Buddha, then you want to get rid of it, you want to heal it, you want to make it so it's not there anymore. And when the arahat does this, revulsion to the five khandhas, he lets go of those five khandhas and enters nirodha. And that's the happiness here and now for the arahat. Or he enters the attainment of the experience of the fruit of arahat. Either way, he's let go temporarily of these five khandhas. And this is pointing again to this idea, to this realization that there is nothing in this world, in this body and mind, worthy of attaching to, worthy of having, worthy of experiencing. This gives rise to nibbida, which gives rise to viraga, which gives rise to vimutti, rise to freedom. And this is always the way. If one hasn't got a healthy aversion towards the things of the world, one will never turn away from them. If one hasn't got a healthy aversion to the experience of thought, one will never stop thinking. If one hasn't got a healthy aversion to the world of the five senses and all that's caught up in them, then one will never get into jhana. If one hasn't got an aversion to the business of the world, of building monasteries, of going from place to place, of building up Buddhist societies or monasteries, if one hasn't got a healthy aversion to that, that's where one gets stuck. This is a letting go of the whole lot. Why do we let go of the whole lot? Because we see the whole lot is dukkha. Sabbe sankhara dukkha. If it's not sabbe, if it's not all of this stuff is dukkha, then you won't let go of all sankharas. The first noble truth is one of the most powerful. It's through not understanding the depth of dukkha. Through thinking that somehow we can just get rid of attachments and still have existence and enjoy it. That's the illusion. That's what stops one from being enlightened. The idea that all existence is dukkha means that whether one likes it or not, that experience will mean that one will turn away from continued existence. That is what gets you off the wheel. Realizing that there's nothing on the wheel, not even a nook or a cranny worthy of holding on to, worthy of finding a happy place on the wheel somewhere. And it's not, as I mentioned many times, it's not a matter of what you choose to do or not choose to do. Choice is not in your power. Choice is conditioned like everything else. You can no longer choose to stay in samsara longer, even for wholesome reasons like the benefit of all other sentient beings. Such an idea cannot arise in the mind of someone who has seen the Dhamma. Such an idea can only arise in a puttacchana, someone who's yet to understand the depth of dukkha. Once the depth of dukkha is understood, then there's no way that one can resist. There's no way that one can stop the natural process of getting out of that which is completely unadulterated, 100% suffering. And it is only because one realizes that, that it becomes possible to let go of the defilements of desire and aversion, or desire and ill will, hatred. If one doesn't see that everything is dukkha, one will still have some desire somewhere for something, some craving for some things. Even if it's a craving, may all beings be enlightened also. One still has something there which keeps you on the wheel. If you see what the Buddha saw, the whole works, sabbe sankhara, is dukkha. It automatically gives rise to nibbida, it automatically gives rise to viraga, dispassion, automatically gives rise to vimutti, freedom from all of this. You're on the path, seven lifetimes, one lifetime, there's no way of stopping it. Seven lifetime max. That's if you're slow. The first noble truth being first, again the most powerful. Second noble truth of the cause for suffering, craving. What type of craving though? Not just any type of tanha. The Buddha, in the explanation of the second noble truth, katamacha bhikkhave dukkha samudaya, what is the cause of dukkha, the origin of dukkha? He said, yayan tanha pono bhavika nandi raga sahagata tatra tatra binandini sayati dang kama tanha bhava tanha vibhava tanha. He said, it's that tanha which leads to rebirth. The Ponobhavika tanha. Not just any tanha, the Ponobhavika tanha. The tanha, the craving which leads to rebirth. Nandi Raga Sahagata, which is caught up with delights and desire, Nandi and Raga. Ever finding delight here and there, Tatra Tatra Binandini. It's that type of danha, that type of craving, which leads to the problem. The rebirth producing danha. And as I pointed out here before in a beautiful sutta where Ananda, Venerable Ananda, pointed out there is a type of dhanha which is not leading to rebirth, but actually which leads to its opposite, the ending of rebirth type dhanha. Then he gave an example that in a monastery you hear that one of your fellow monks has become fully enlightened as an arahat. And the craving comes up, oh, may I achieve that same state. And Ananda pointed out, and all the arahats since have acclaimed that this is valid, that craving to do the same will lead to the ending of suffering, will lead to the attainment of enlightenment. The craving to be enlightened is something which leads to enlightenment. You cannot say all craving is going to lead to dukkha. The Buddha never said that. In the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, if one looks at this clearly, one sees that it is that type of danha which leads to rebirth, the Ponobhavika, the rebirth type danha, which is caught up with delight and desire, ever finding delight here and there, namely the three things, the karma danha, the craving caught up with the five senses, the karma danha, the craving caught up with delighting in the five senses, the bhava danha, the craving which is caught up with existence itself, with wanting to be, with being, and the craving, vibhava danha, the craving of wanting to be annihilated, the materialistic craving which wants to enjoy everything and then one day go to sleep and never have to reap the consequences of one's actions. The first type of craving, I will point out that it does not include the craving for the delight of the sixth sense, the craving of jhanas. And that's an important point, because the craving for the attainment of jhanas is not something which leads to rebirth, in the sense that, as I read out on last Wednesday in the Pasadika Sutta, those who crave for and indulge in the jhanas, the things expected of them is to gain the four stages of enlightenment. And it needs to be pointed out that in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the craving for the pleasures of the mind, the jhana states, is not pointed out, is not included as one of the cravings. And the bhava danha, the craving just to exist, to be, and the vibhava danha, the craving of wanting to annihilate oneself, having enjoyed everything to the full. These are the cravings which lead to rebirth. It's interesting that the craving to be enlightened leads to rebirth. So the craving to be annihilated leads to rebirth. The suicidal tendencies in a human being do not lead to the end of suffering, but only to more suffering, more rebirth, more going round in a cycle of rebirths. And the third noble truth, the ending of this suffering, it is caused by yo tasayeva danhaya seza viraga nirodha, the complete ending, cessation of that danha just referred to. the complete ending and cessation of the craving which leads to rebirth. In other words, the ending of rebirth. How's that done, Charko? Giving up. Patinisago, renouncing. Muti is releasing. Annalayo, that during the last Vaso I pointed out to the now the novices here, the alayo, the opposite of analayo, has this beautiful meaning of like the roosting, the place where chickens go up to at night. Analayo is no roosting, no place where the mind goes to rest, to find peace, refuge, security, no place where it can find happiness, sukha. No roosting is my preferred. It's usually say no, was it no grasping? But like no roosting, I like that one much better. It's more evocative. Annalayo. And this is a way to achieve the ending of dhanha. Oh sorry, this is the ending of dhanha. The ending of dukkha, sorry. By renouncing that dhanha, by giving it no place to roost. And the path is the old Eightfold Path, which we all know very well. This is a path which leads to the ending of dukkha. And that path begins with right understanding. Again, the understanding of dukkha is so important. If we don't understand dukkha, we don't know. We can't understand what can cause it. And the craving, we don't know what particular type of craving is the cause of this dukkha. And therefore we don't know what to give up. Fortunately though, the path, the Eightfold Path as we practice it, and that path is usually explained as Sila, Samadhi and Panya. There's the virtue, the practice of deep, peaceful concentration and wisdom. This is a path which the Buddha said leads to the eradication of dukkha. And again, it's done haphazardly at first. And once it starts to come together, it starts to come together at samadhiti, first of all, right view, purified at the stream enterer. It also has Samma Samadhi, which is always in the suttas described as the four jhanas. This is Samma Samadhi, right concentration, the factor of the Eightfold Path. The jhana states being an important part of the Eightfold Path, which leads to the ending of dukkha. Again, another pointing out that the practice of jhanas being part of the Eightfold Path is the way out of dukkha and doesn't create more. Also includes Sammavayama, this a right effort which requires the arousing of will, the arousing of energy, the striving, which also requires a goal to strive towards. People who say there's nothing to attain, there's nothing to reach, there's nothing to gain, do not understand the Dhamma. They become very popular because people like to hear they're already enlightened, they're already Buddha, or they're already there and there's nothing they need to do. That's why it's popular and gains a lot of currency. Unfortunately, it's not how the Buddha taught, and it doesn't lead to enlightenment. There is something to be attained. The Buddha said there was, the Buddha said you need to develop energy to attain this. And one can use one's common sense to know the truth of this. And ask anyone who's practiced a long time and has got the reputation as being enlightened, and they will encourage effort. They will encourage you to gain that which you've yet to gain, to reach that which you've not yet reached, to do the task, and don't give up yet. All the best monasteries which I've been to, where the monks, even the nuns, have had a high reputation of being enlightened beings. It's always a great place of great energy where the people are striving, are sitting long periods, they're not taking it easy. is the Eightfold Path. The Buddha said that the First Noble Truth, Parinyayanti, should be understood thoroughly. Parijanati, to be known all around. Not just to be known, but thoroughly, completely, all around, every aspect. And this is the point I'm trying to bring out again and again. It's because we don't thoroughly know dukkha. This part of dukkha we haven't yet found out. It's something which we refuse to accept because of our conditioning, because of the way we want to see things. And it's that which stops you getting the first part and fruit. This old conditioning, the stubbornness of the mind. I'm right, the Buddha's wrong. Quite often that comes out as, I'm right, the Buddha didn't mean that, he meant this. Twisting the obvious meaning of the Buddha's teachings. And this is what happens, because we resist and we don't see the fullness, the profundity of the Buddha's teaching about dukkha. If you do, it just gives such a release to the mind, a freedom. Nibbida comes up, and the result of Nibbida is you're detached. You've left the world, and you bliss out. And from that bliss, you realize that that was a realization. Parinyayanti needs to be understood thoroughly. The cause, that craving which leads to rebirth, needs to be abolished, abandoned, pahataba. It needs to be given up, not just to be looked upon with equanimity, not just to be looked upon with mindfulness, it needs to be abandoned. It needs to be thrown away. As if you've got something in your hand, you don't just look at it with mindfulness, you don't look at it with equanimity, you chuck it away. Throw it out. Get rid of it. It needs to be abandoned. The third noble truth, the end of suffering, needs to be realized, needs to be attained. Satchikātabhaṃ. And if anyone ever tells you there's nothing to be attained, nothing to be reached, you say, well, the Buddha taught the third noble truth, Satchikātabhaṃ, needs to be attained, needs to be reached, needs to be realized. There is something to be realized. It's the third noble truth, the end of suffering. This is our goal, this is our meaning. And if you don't try, you will never achieve. Go for it. Put everything you've got into this. Satchikātabhaṃ. And how do you put everything you've got into it? By developing bhāvetabhaṃ, the Eightfold Path. Bhāvana, making it come into existence, purifying it, developing it, making much of the Eightfold Path. Right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, mindfulness, effort, and jhana states in samadhi. Make these become. And then you're doing what the Buddha said you should do with the Four Noble Truths in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And the Buddha said, after giving this beautiful discourse, that these are the things which Abhinyaya, Sambodaya, Nibbanaya, Sangvatanti. These are the things which lead, sorry, to upasama, to peace, to knowledge, Abhinya, Sambodhi, the enlightened wisdom, and Nibbana. Nibbana, full enlightenment. And he said before that he'd understood the Four Noble Truths, he couldn't really call himself enlightened. Now that he had, because of that knowledge, because he'd fully understood the First Noble Truth, because he'd abandoned all craving which leaded to rebirth, he still had the craving which helped him to help other beings, called compassion. When he'd realized the third noble truth, the ending of suffering, when he'd fully developed the Eightfold Path, he could call himself an Arahat, enlightened Buddha. When they said those words, Kondanya, who at first were skeptical about the Buddha's enlightenment, understood whatever is of a nature to arise, all of that is of a nature to cease. Impermanent. And what is impermanent? That's dukkha. What is dukkha is not self. Through the deep understanding of the depth, breadth, full meaning of impermanence, at the same time he understood dukkha anatta. He understood the three characteristics. Understood there was not a self in there at all. All of this was impermanent. How could any of this be a self? How could he own anything when these things were just passing, coming and going? The five khandhas, impermanent. How can you own anything which by their nature is passing from you? How can they be you? How can there be anything else other than dukkha? What is impermanent, leave alone. It's not yours. Don't play with it. And Kondanya understood this. He became the first of the disciples of the Buddha who saw what the Buddha saw. The eye of the Dhamma Chakku, arose in Kondanya. He who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. He understood what the Buddha truly was as a person. People use that word. Until you've got the first path and fruit, you don't know what a Buddha is. When you have the first path and fruit and you know what the Buddha is, just incredible faith and trust in this being, this thing we call a Buddha, arises in you. And you can bow with tears. You know the Dhamma, you can bow with tears. You know what it means to be an Arya, and you bow to the Arya Sangha with tears. With great gratefulness which you've has no bounds. You have the full faith, the faith through knowledge in the Triple Gem. And you can understand why, when that happened, the 10,000-fold world system shook. So this is all I wish to say this evening on the Dhammacakka Pavattana Sutta on Asarha Puja, the day after Asarha Puja, the full moon day of July, 2538 years after the Buddha passed away. Is there any comments or questions anyone would like to ask on that discourse?